taken under advisement. And we will turn to our last case for today. It looks like we're about a minute into the afternoon. Kristen Majeski against Metro Life Insurance Company. Mr. Dubofsky.
I guess I have to start. Good afternoon.
I think so.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Mark Dubofsky. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Kristen Majeski. In the district court's explanation of the role of a court in reviewing an ERISA case under the arbitrary and capricious or abusive discretion standard of review, the court's statement about a reasonableness standard in considering the possibility of a conflict is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in MetLife versus Glenn, and it has created a situation where this court is in conflict with both the Sixth and the Ninth Circuits, leaving residents of the Seventh Circuit with far less protection of their employee benefits than that enjoyed by residents of the Sixth and Ninth Circuits.
But this court has said that conflict of interest is a factor we take into account. We've just said that it's not the be-all and the end-all. We don't every time you see some type of conflict, and of course there are different kinds that one would spot, that automatically kicks you back to de novo consideration of the decision.
Your Honor is absolutely correct, and I think the distinction here is between the standard of review and the scope of review. What the Supreme Court said in Glenn was that the conflict is always a factor to be taken into consideration, where it may be given greater consideration if the conflict is shown to have directly infected the decision, or lesser consideration if there's no evidence that the conflict infected the decision, that there was no history of biased claims administration, that there were efforts made to assure accuracy.
So what kind of evidence do you think exists in this record to show that conflict directly affected the decision?
I think that there are two issues in particular that bear on what the Supreme Court referred to in Glenn as procedural unreasonableness. The first issue has to do with the insurance company's reliance on Dr. Marion, and the second issue has to do with the insurance company rushing a decision after they had been put on notice that Dr. Marion was very well a biased claim reviewer. And instead of waiting for the transcript that they knew was on its way, they rushed a final decision affirming the denial of benefits and indicating that the record was completely closed at that point and no further information would be considered.
But you say rushed a decision, and I'm thinking at least that if the insurance company came along and said, we just followed the same time schedule that we follow in every single case, and we didn't give you special treatment, isn't that a sign of procedural regularity rather than irregularity?
Potentially, yes. But the situation that existed here was effectively that the plaintiff was sandbagged, that the plaintiff learned very, very late in the game that this individual, Dr. Philip Marion, had been retained to review the claim. We weren't even provided with a copy of Dr. Marion's review. We only learned about that from one of the physicians who had contacted us. At that point, we knew that the time was running out. We immediately jumped on the issue based on what we had already learned concerning Dr. Marion and presented that evidence to the insurance company, which the insurance company then refused to give consideration to. There are a lot of problems with the way in which MetLife took Dr. Marion's opinion into consideration.
You seem to see Dr. Marion's statement that he only finds for a claimant, whatever it was, 5% of the time, 5 to 10% of the time, as the smoking gun that he is, in fact, a biased reviewer. But, of course, every case doesn't go to reviewers, and maybe MetLife is right on a lot of them. Can we draw that inference from this comment?
I don't think the court can draw a conclusive inference, but it should raise a question in the court's mind that if this doctor is being retained as frequently as he's being retained,
this does seem to be his business. I understand
that. He only finds the claimant disabled 5% of the time. That means he's disagreeing with a collection of treating physicians 95% of the time. There should at least be a little light that goes off in somebody's mind that maybe this guy is not giving objective consideration.
So what would a fair rate be if someone were to be unbiased? Would it be 25% or 50%?
I mean, one would expect 50-50.
50-50.
Given the fact that all of these claims are supported in many instances, well, obviously, you can play games with statistics.
But you're drawing the assumption that the only claims that reach a reviewer, whether it's Dr. Marion or somebody else, are the claims where the file from the treating physicians and perhaps other retained experts, for all I know, all indicate, yes, you should give benefits, and so MetLife sends it off. You don't think they ever send off?
No, I think what happens more frequently, Your Honor, and of course this is outside the record, is you may find a situation where somebody's being treated by three or four doctors, and two doctors might find unequivocally that the patient is disabled, and two might be a little bit equivocal, or one might say, well, I don't know. And in that case, it's wholly appropriate to retain somebody. But getting to the gist of the problem, we're talking about a reviewing doctor. We're talking about somebody who has never examined the patient. And as this court pointed out very recently in the Jenkins case, there has to be concern about this term independent medical evaluator. And the court said the court should be concerned how much the person is paid, how often he or she is used, are important considerations that bear on what weight should be attached to their reports. And we have this doctor who has never examined Ms. Majewski, and he writes in his report, the FCE does not document functional limitations precluding sedentary work. That's a quote from his report. As a matter of fact, the FCE explicitly stated that there were restrictions that preclude Ms. Majewski from performing her occupation. Dr. Marion wasn't even answering the right question.
Okay, I have two questions to ask you about. One of them is really about Dr. Marion, the other's a broader one. When Dr. Marion conducted his review, did he have in front of him Dr. Hardin's evaluation and Dr. Weiss's questionnaire?
He lists in his initial report that he did have a copy of the FCE, the functional capacity evaluation that was done by Ms. Hardin.
Ms. Hardin, sorry, yeah.
And
right.
That he did have Dr. Weiss's records as well. Of course, since he's already given an ipsy-dixit conclusion that the FCE doesn't state what the FCE in fact stated, one has to wonder whether he actually reviewed all of those records as well.
And my other question, I'll be quick because I see you're getting to your rebuttal time. It seems like this is a case where perhaps a particular individual is where the structure of exertional work doesn't operate in lockstep. So maybe you can't do your existing job, which is sedentary. Maybe you could do something that's actually at a higher exertional level. Is that a correct way to look at this record?
It is, as odd as that might seem, but the particular question to be asked under the terms of both the short-term and the long-term disability plan is, can you perform your occupation? The only document...
Well, it doesn't matter if she could do something, if she could become a logger or something. If she can't perform her occupation, that's the only relevant question.
Until you pass the transition to the any occupation standard later. But that was not at issue,
okay,
either before MetLife at this time or before the district court.
Quickly, Mr. Dubofsky, is both the short-term and long-term disability benefit before us or just the short-term?
Well, we had applied for both. We certainly passed the transition date from short-term to long-term while we were in the midst of the appeals. I'll reserve the rest.
The only actual decision MetLife made was on the short-term application, right?
That would be correct.
Okay. All right, Ms. Roseboro.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The question before the Court is, of course, whether or not MetLife's decision to terminate Ms. Majewski's short-term disability benefits was unreasonable, arbitrary and capricious, and abuse of its discretion under the plan. And to answer your question, Your Honor, the question before this court only relates to the availability for short-term disability benefits. MetLife never made a determination and never received an application for long-term disability benefits from Ms. Majewski. In the, considering whether or not the record shows any arbitrariness or capriciousness on MetLife's part, before you even get to the issue of Dr. Marion, it's appropriate to look at the evidence that was submitted by Ms. Majewski and the evidence that comes from her own treating physician's review. Significant, and Mr. Dubosky relies on the evidence of Dr. Weiss's functional capacity questionnaire, which he provided in response to an inquiry from plaintiff's counsel. That on that questionnaire, he indicates that Ms. Majewski can sit for 4 hours out of an 8-hour day, can stand for 4 hours out of an 8-hour day, does not require any significant periods of time for walking around during an 8-hour day, that she can take breaks of up to 5 minutes out of every 40 or 45 minutes and be comfortable, indicates no limitations on her ability to use fine finger manipulations, a determination that's later verified by one of the physical therapists that evaluates Ms. Majewski. So even Dr. Weiss's opinion and his answers to the questions on the functional capacity questionnaire do not indicate that Ms. Majewski is disabled from performing the terms of her job. And the definition of disability under the short-term disability plan at issue here was whether or not she could perform the duties of her own occupation, which was to be a nurse consultant, sufficiently to earn at least 80% of the income that she was getting from her current employer.
But the thing is, I mean, he does change. I mean, I realize the parties have been debating about this. He changes the fine manipulation for the finger from 100% to zero. She's obviously suffering from pain as she is, whether it's carpal tunnel or whatever it may be. It's very painful for her to do this. And I'm concerned that MetLife seems to be taking the position that we've criticized in the past, that pain isn't real, you know, that pain isn't something that can affect somebody's ability to do a job.
And absolutely that's not the case here. As you will see that in the upheld letters that MetLife provides, both in upholding the determination or initially terminating her short-term disability benefits, and later in the upheld decision on the appeal, both carefully evaluate the pain that she reports. And I guess the report that most
clearly... What about Hardin's statement that Majewski was incapable of typing and sitting? I don't see Dr. Marion addressing that.
Well, two things. One is Dr. Weiss provided or did an objective test of Ms. Majewski's sitting ability, the slump test, and found no impairment in that.
But Ms. Hardin gave a typing test, a 30-minute typing test or something, and she could only accomplish 8 minutes or so?
Well, she gives a typing test, and she reports that over the course of the 30 minutes that she exhibited pain behaviors with the holding of her arm, releasing of her arm, and then says overall that she finds some minimal impairment to the right hand at the conclusion of the report.
She also says that Majewski cannot sit or type sufficiently to return to her former job as a nurse consultant.
That's after
Dr. Marion doesn't engage with this.
I take issue with that, Your Honor. Dr. Marion does respond to that and does say that her duties as a nurse consultant can be performed by sitting and standing as long as she has the opportunity to change her position.
What I'm saying, though, is he doesn't say there was a test done by Hardin which had these results. I disagree with that test for the following reasons, even though I haven't watched her type. I mean, we don't see him working with the evidence. We see conclusions, which are easy enough to write out.
And I think the important thing there is that looking at Ms. Hardin's report of what she saw in those behaviors is that she herself concludes that there's only some minimal evidence of some impairment in the right hand, even having seen these, observed these
behaviors. Back to the pain point, you know, there are physical underlying conditions. This is not a case where somebody's got an entirely somatoform disorder. This is, you know, cervical radiculitis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, she's got all kinds of physical things that could lead to these very problems.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's no contradiction here in the record that she did have some cervical degeneration.
And
there
nobody thinks she's holding back either. We don't see, as we often do in these cases, any signal by the doctors that she's exaggerating.
Dr. Weiss says in his evaluation that he doesn't find her to be a malingerer. He does disagree with Dr. Gleason's conclusion that she was suffering from cervical radiculitis, but he doesn't find her to be a malingerer, and nor does Dr. Marion's opinion suggest that.
And Harden thinks she really gave it her all, too. She wasn't holding back.
Right, that she didn't hold back. But as anybody who's closed on a house knows, being forced to sign your name for 50 times in 20 minutes can produce pain. The ultimate thing of Nurse Harden's look here and seeing what she was doing over the course of that 30 minutes and seeing how she needed to alter her position in order to be comfortable in order to type continuously for 30 minutes doesn't suggest that she couldn't perform the telephone, computer, and duties of a nurse consultant. She was offered the opportunity to come into work and to request accommodations that were consistent with the physical limitations noted by Dr. Weiss, and presumably that she would be able to change her position frequently enough and sit and stand frequently enough and to move her hands frequently enough in different ways in order to perform the work of an 8-hour day. But a determination in the record, the reasonableness of MetLife's determination, is based on the substantial evidence that neither Dr. Weiss never concluded that she was unable to go to work. In fact, he concluded that she could engage in significant conduct that was consistent with an 8-hour workday.
But not her own job. I don't see MetLife ever saying, for example, that she didn't have to type anymore and she could dictate everything or something.
There was never that opportunity. Once she left work on June 16th, she never returned and she never responded to the invitation to come into the office to discuss what accommodations might be necessary to allow her to work. So there's no evidence in the record that she couldn't perform her job by dictating or that she couldn't sit or stand as she did her work as a nurse consultant or that the frequency at which she's required to type or the consistency of typing as opposed to her work on the telephone. Or
so MetLife self-insures?
A portion of the plan is self-insured, Your Honor.
So there definitely is, in a Glenn sense, a conflict of interest here.
Got it out here. There is a legal conflict of interest here. Mr. Dubofsky suggests that this court revisit the standard of review that the court has consistently held applied to these kinds of cases both before and after Glenn. And I would suggest that this case, where the district court found such a strong support in the record for the decision reached by MetLife, doesn't provide any opportunity for reconsideration of the standard of review. And it's clear from the record in this case that the district court did, in fact, consider the conflict of interest, weighted in its analysis, and still concluded that the record provided supported the reasonableness of MetLife's decision. And on that basis, we would ask the court to affirm. If there are no further questions, I'll take my seat.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Dubofsky?
As the court pointed out in the questions directed to counsel, there really was inadequate consideration given by MetLife to the pain complaints. The initial denial said insufficient objective findings. The final denial said insufficient objective findings. We had the objective findings. We had the opinions of Dr. Gleason, Dr. Weiss, Dr. Agarwal, Ms. Garbish, the physical therapist, explicitly lists objective findings. Ms. Harden makes objective findings. And all of their findings relate to Ms. Majewski's ability to perform her job, not a job. MetLife's entire determination was focused on a job, not her job. But the plan requires consideration of her occupation. With respect to the functional capacity evaluation, again, this court ruled just a couple of months ago in the Ledger case where a functional capacity evaluation is presented and pain is at issue, the plan must explain why, despite evidence to the contrary in the FCE, it nevertheless finds Ms. Ledger's complaints of pain unreliable, and why, if the complaints in fact are reliable, the pain Ms. Ledger is experiencing is not completely debilitating. This case suffers from the exact same deficiency, and for that reason, we urge the court to reverse the court below.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement, and the court will be in recess.